Hey guys, welcome to the Dad's Group podcast. My name is Blair.
And I'm Burnsy. And here at Dad's Group, we're all about helping fathers and helping families. And what we're trying to do with this podcast is bring you conversations that are going to build you up as a dad and that's going to support your family and your growth as a family.
Exactly, mate. And we're very passionate about this space, obviously, which is why we're here. But I want to discuss something real quick before we get started today. I want to discuss something that came out of last week's episode with Mark Matthews. Mark shared with us about the physical preparation behind being a pro big wave surfer, which we all kind of know about to a point. But what hit me the most was what he was sharing about his mental preparation. That's something I hadn't heard about before and really got my attention. He was talking about how he would prepare, pretty much feel fear the whole time he was out on the surf, but how that obviously didn't stop him because he kept on doing it and became a pro at it, and that he had to mentally prepare for bad situations that could arise. Like, so for example, getting dunked by a massive wave, right? If you stiffen up, well, that could end really bad. That's not what you want to do. You don't want to stiffen up. So what I want to chat about today, well, how do we mentally prepare for our struggles with fatherhood? And we know it's hard, but if we pay attention, we obviously learn our triggers. So what I want to do is have that chat about, well, how do we mentally prepare for the bad situations that could arise in our fatherhood, that, you know, to prevent our triggers or to deal with those triggers when they arise? How do we mentally prepare?
Yeah. So it's almost like putting in the work before those tough situations come up.
Hey? Exactly.
Yeah. A technique, and I'm going to go really practical with this one.
Yeah.
A technique I learned years ago when I started doing speaking in schools is a thing called visualization.
Yeah.
So basically, like, picturing every step of the process of every potential outcome before you get into it. And like, the science behind it, from what I understand, is like, roughly your brain doesn't really discriminate against memories that you actually have or memories that you've created or like imagined.
Mm-hmm.
And so you basically can set yourself up to have skills and experience and tools to draw on, even if you're going into a situation for the first time, just by like picturing and imagining that situation beforehand. So for me, my practice every morning is just to think about, like, all right, like, we've got daycare drop off coming up. Let's just picture driving the daycare, and what am I going to do to keep that energy up and really encourage my little fella before we even step through the door? And what am I going to do? How am I going to speak to him? What's the energy I'm going to have when I unbuckle him from his seat and pull him out and we walk in the door? And then when I hand him over to one of the educators, like, what's the energy I'm bringing? Am I, like, what's my body language even? And so I've stepped it all out so that when I actually get there, if he's happy, I'm good. If he's upset, I'm good. Like, I've got basically like my whole response mapped out so that I'm good to go, whatever it is. And that works for me. Yeah. In the situations like with the daycare drop off, or, you know, just picturing like, what if he doesn't like what we've prepped for dinner? And even just within myself, what if I have a reaction to him being upset? How do I confront and respond to the reaction within myself? And so, yeah, it's doing that work before we even get to it so that I can bring my best self to that situation.
Yeah, that's good, man. And that's actually really cool. I haven't thought about that before. And I'll do something similar. Like, so for me, again, it's like I said, when we're aware, when we reflect and when we have conversation with our partners or mates, like a dad's group or whatever else, you know, we start to identify our triggers, you know, and I think what you said then, like, it rings true for me quite a lot of like preparing my thoughts for the day, right? And you're going to hear me share about this a lot because it's been so big for me. But showers in the morning, right? So cold shower in the morning kicks me right to the face. It freezes me. It sucks. I hate it. I don't enjoy it. But, and again, we've got to have a proper chat about this, bring some scientific discussion to this and not just something that one of Blair's crazy things. But the amount of dopamine that releases to your brain, all that sort of stuff, is quite high. Anyway, but what I do afterwards, like, not in that shock moment of being in the cold water, but afterwards, like, you know, obviously drying myself off, getting changed, I'm then straight away thinking about, all right, what is the tone that I want to take now, right? So this is Charlie's first year of school. So that's our oldest first year in school. Our other three aren't in school yet. And we've got two in daycare. And they're in daycare on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And I know that Tuesdays and Thursday mornings, getting ready for school, getting everyone out the door, lunches packed, everything, is a nightmare. It's so hard, right? And I know that's a trigger for me. So I, you know, in that morning, I will wake up. And when I do this well, I didn't do this morning. And seriously, like I told you before, I didn't end well. Like I did not respond to situations well. But I'm thinking through it. And I'm like, all right, I know I don't want to be cranky. I know that I want to have a good time with my kids before they go to school. And so I like, you know, they get distracted while they're eating. They take forever, or they just, you know, I've asked them five times to go get their shoes or whatever else. It's like, all right, well, what do I need to do to make this morning pleasant? I've asked them two times to go get their shoes. All right, let's go get your shoes together. Now, there's a balance there because obviously I want to teach them to be able to get their own shoes on their own. But I've got to think about, well, what's more important? Do I lose it and start yelling, or am I, you know, dealing with the situation, trying to use it as a teaching moment as much as possible, but using the situation and just trying to get through those difficult situations, giving myself some slack and being like picking my choosing, my teaching moments rather than trying to use every situation as a teaching moment. Well, what ones can I actually best teach in? You know, I can't teach if I'm cracking it. I mean, I'm just going to make my kids cry. Like, it doesn't make any sense to do it then. So that's, has been a big one, is like, again, like, yeah, being aware of my triggers, but putting things in place. What I want to do is, I mean, I've spoken about this a lot. We just haven't got there yet because we're just tired. Is I want to do meal preps beforehand. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, you know, we do a big preparation on a Sunday, chuck things in the freezer. Sorry, on the morning, I'll just chuck it in their lunch boxes and we're good to go. So make it as easy as possible. But definitely, like what you said was good, because I hadn't thought of actually visualizing it. I'm just like trying to go through my head, all right, I'm going to do good this morning, I'm going to do good this morning. But going through the normal morning routine and preparing for that has been really, really helpful. But like I said, I don't do it every time. Like sometimes I'm just too tired and it's like, I cannot be bothered having a cold shower. Like I just like, I hate it. I don't ever enjoy it. But straight afterwards, like I know my trigger points. And again, like I didn't do that cold shower. I didn't go into those routines. I didn't do those things that I know that are going to help me.
Yeah.
And I responded poorly, you know, and I hated it.
Yeah. Oh man, I've got a list as long as my arm of things that I know I can be doing to set myself up better. Like, I've been using mindfulness meditation in my work and schools for years, and yet, like, I suck at just putting in that discipline to do it myself in my own practice.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, after the fact, I'm like, oh yeah, I should do some mindfulness now. Just cut, but like, I don't do it before something happens that I'm ready for it. Like, it's just stuff like that. Hey, like putting the work in so that we're good to go in the moment, instead of being a victim to our reactions or a victim to like our emotions and feelings as they come up. Like, we actually have that power to, as you say, like set ourselves up to be that best version dad that we can be in every situation. You know, and I can see, like dozens of situations each day where I'm just coming in so passive and reactionary.
Yeah.
And I just think, like, if I could flip that switch and come in so much more mentally prepared, like, you know, I could be a big wave surfer dad instead of like kicking my flippers in the shallows dad.
It's so true, mate. And I like am constantly, you know, having conversations with my mates about, you know, preparing to be a dad still. Like I am a dad now, but I'm still preparing for those situations, and I want to be proactive with it. I need to exercise that, like put in a lot of work to my work life. I know actually, which is something I want to do too, is the importance of my physical health and how that actually helps with my mental health. Like it really does. So I'm looking into signing up into a gym.
Nice.
But again, just like, you know, I'm willing to do these exercises in every area of my life. But why is fatherhood so hard? You know, like, I mean, why is fatherhood so hard to put those, or even marriage, all that sort of stuff? Like it's, I feel like it's one of those hard things, like harder things to do for some reason, probably because they're so comfortable. I don't know what it is, but I want to be intentional with that. Like Amy and I as well, you know, I had a conversation with a mate the other day, and I was just sort of recommending, oh, why don't you go to couples counseling, right? And it's just a little bit of a, you know, pause there. It's like, Because I had the same feeling about couples counseling. It's like, well, that's the last resort. Like, I don't want to go to couples counseling if it's the last resort. Like, we're not there yet. I'm like, oh, no, it's not. It's not. Like, from mine and Amy's experience, because this is what was said to us, and it was so true after we did it. No, it's a gym. It's a relationship gym. You know what I mean? It's our exercise of becoming better at communicating. It's giving us the tools and the exercises to be able to communicate better. And our relationship has been stronger. We didn't go to couples counseling because we nearly got a divorce or something. We actually got because we found like we need exercise in this space. And it was really, really powerful and really helpful. So that's definitely one too, is looking outside of the things that I can do and get help where I need the help, you know.
Absolutely.
Because that's the thing is even with like, you know, sport athletes, right, professional athletes, they have coaches, you know, they have people walking them through, identifying things for them over the whole team, not even just the individual. Like they have a coach over the whole team. And so if we've got someone be able to speak into our team, which is our family, it's really helpful. It's really helpful to get that advice and those tips and everything else.
For sure. For sure. And I think what we're hitting on here is that the importance of doing the work beforehand, because when you're in the moment and the emotions are high, you're less likely and less able to be able to respond with like your full capacity of emotional intelligence, skills, tools. Like you just, when the emotions are that high, you're less likely to be able to respond as your best self. And that actually segues really nicely into the interview we're going to share with you guys today. We talked with Dr. Justin Coulson and Dr. Justin Coulson. I got that wrong so many times. Hey, I was like practicing it, but Dr. Justin Coulson and, our listeners might recognize his name. He built a platform, an online platform called, Happy Families, which has become one of Australia's most trusted brands in terms of that family support and resourcing. He also is a co-host and parenting expert on the Channel 9 program, Parental Guidance, which season 2 is coming out really soon. So, and he talked about this because one of the things he talks about is high emotion, low intelligence, meaning that, as I said before, like when your emotions are that high, you're less likely to be able to respond as your best self. And so, yeah, he in this conversation brought so many tools and techniques and stories and experiences that I think will be really helpful for our dads and our listeners in terms of how do we do that prep beforehand? And also just like, how do we build happier families? How do we get our families to that point or even beyond that point if we're there already? So just a really awesome conversation, so much gold here. And I think our listeners will really get a lot out of this. So Dr. Justin Coulson, just an incredible, incredible person and man to talk with. He brings so much experience as a speaker, as a parental expert, as a TV special guest on just about every major news morning program in Australia. So he definitely comes with tons of experience, and this will be such a great listen for our listeners.
Enjoy, guys.
Well, welcome to the Dad's Group podcast, Dr. Justin Coulson. We start all of our podcasts by asking our guest, how are you going out of 10? So, Justin, how are you out of 10 today?
Literally today, I would be, I reckon, about somewhere between 9.5 and 10 out of 10.
That's awesome.
Yeah, really, really thriving at the moment, really doing well. My wife and I have just celebrated in the last little while our 25th wedding anniversary. We've also had a really nice family holiday and we've just kind of, we're doing good things and we're at a point now where our three oldest kids are adults, right? They've moved out of the house. Well, actually, they haven't fully moved out of the house. One of them's still with us, but the first two have. The third one's at uni, though. We only see her a few days a week. And our younger kids are all at an age now where most of the time they can actually function well enough that if we need to go and do something, we can. And I never thought we'd get there. As we were raising six little kids, oh, my goodness, it was exhausting. It was just such hard work. And so to be at this point now is great. And I think outside of the parenting realm, I'm in a really fortunate situation where I get to do work that is personally fulfilling and meaningful. I mean, every day I get to think about ways that I can help people to have happier families. And then I get the emails and the messages from people saying thank you. And it just, I mean, Adam, it's a really great thing to be able to do.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. And probably for me, it's interesting hearing about the children that are grown up but still coming home, because that's sort of the stage of life that me and my wife are still in. We're still leeching off the parents as much as we can as we raise our little, we've got nearly 18 month old. So I sort of relate, but not directly.
It's funny though, because I watched my parents and my wife's parents, and it's occurred to us over the years, it just doesn't stop.
Yeah.
Like, you never actually stop being a parent. The responsibilities change, but you constantly live your life with your heart. Well, as the kids get older, your heart is in a different state or in a different country or in a different house. And so like my first daughter, she and her husband are about to make Kylie and I grandparents, right? So that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
But our second daughter, she's in the UK at the moment, and we just kind of live for the opportunities for them to come back. We spent the first 18 years wondering when they would finally leave. And as soon as they were gone, we were like, hey, you're going to come over for a roast on Sunday? Like, we really, there is something, Adam, that is so transcendent about healthy family relationships. Yeah. When you see, as a dad, when you're in the labor room, and let's assume that everything goes well and your wife, partner is able to have a natural birth. If you're anything like me, that moment when you see that baby appear, it's completely indescribable. There are no words for it. It's mm-hmm. fundamentally, I mean, I'm lost for words even now, and I've tried to describe it for such a long time, and you kind of think it doesn't get any better than this. And the reality is, it kind of doesn't. For the next 18 years, it's one long downhill from there. It's really hard, but parenting is just so extraordinary, and you have the highs are just so very, very high. The lows are hard, but it's just an amazing experience. So I love what I get to do, because it's really dealing with the absolute core of who we are and what matters most to us. And what I love about a conversation like the one we get to have about being a dad is more and more dads are starting to be open to the possibility, the impact that they can have. And
absolutely,
it's just so, so important.
Yeah, for sure. If we could rewind a little bit, just for our dads who maybe haven't come across your work, I could list your bio. It's a very impressive bio. But I'd love to hear from you. Like, what is your work? What is the driver behind your work? What is it that you're trying to achieve, I guess, in what it is you do?
Adam, if I want to answer that question, I need to go back to 2002.
Yep.
So I know that was a long time ago now. It makes me feel kind of old. I'm dating myself seriously. But at that point, I was working for one of Australia's biggest radio stations.
Yeah.
Brisbane's B105. I was a radio announcer. I was the music director. I got to go to work all day, every day, play music, hang out with record company executives or whichever global superstar was traveling through Brisbane, interview them in the studio, go backstage at the concerts. The record companies would take me out to dinner at all of Brisbane's best restaurants. That was a joke, because in 2002, Brisbane didn't have very many good restaurants. I was really competent. I was very good at what I did. You don't get to be a capital city radio announcer without being able to do your job well. I still had a lot to learn. I was only in my mid to late 20s, but I was doing it well, and I had a really clear pathway for how I was going to continue through that radio industry and revolutionize the game in whatever way that happened. Something occurred, though. Like I said, at the end of 2002, my wife, Kylie, had just given birth to our second baby girl. And I came home from work one Saturday afternoon. She said to me, I need you to look after the kids while I go and run some errands. And I was exhausted. So I'm a radio announcer, right? So the Friday night prior, I'd been out until who knows what hour, maybe 2 o'clock in the morning, doing some promotional thing somewhere. And then on Saturday mornings, I worked from 6 till midday on air, which meant that I'd had about three and a half hours of sleep. I'm absolutely exhausted. It's Saturday afternoon, and at Brisbane, springtime afternoon, the sun's coming down and making everything warm. And you know what it's like on those dozy Saturdays? You're just like, oh, I need a nana nap. Like, I'm exhausted. Yeah. And so Kylie said that's fine, because the baby, literally newborn baby, the baby's just gone to sleep and she'll stay asleep until I get back. You just have to put our three-nager to bed. And if you can get her to have a nap, you'll be able to have a sleep And I said, yeah, that's great. Cause when you get home, I'll get up and we'll have a really nice family afternoon. And I was totally on board with this, but the three-year-old, like they get to a point where they just sort of say, I'm too big for a daytime nap. And this was the afternoon that she decided to put that on me. I don't know if you've had this experience or not, Adam, but as a father, when you're really, really tired, you might've noticed that your ability to do parenting well is significantly diminished. And I tried to get her to go to sleep. And I mean, in hindsight, but bearing in mind, I've got a year 12 education and I basically failed year 12. I scored in the bottom 15% of New South Wales. I mean, it was horrendous how badly I did in year 12 because all I wanted to do was be a radio announcer, but I've got next to no education. I certainly know nothing about parenting, fatherhood, psychology, even being a husband. And now I've got this kid who's saying, I don't want to go to sleep. And I'm saying to her, but I don't care what you want because you're tired and you need to go to sleep. And I'm the dad and I know better. And apart from that, I'm tired and I need to go to sleep. And she's sort of saying no. And I'm saying you need to. And again, think about it rationally, right? Like when has anybody ever said, you know, I wasn't tired, but now that you've told me I must be sleepy, let me lay down. Let me have a nap. Yeah. Good point. You know more than me, Dad. I'll listen. And I actually hate telling this story. I wish that in so many ways, I wish that this story was not mine. But over the next, I'm going to guess 10 or 15 minutes, I did everything that you're not supposed to do. I threatened her and then I yelled at her and I called her names and I picked her up and I squeezed her and I smacked her backside and I literally just grabbed her and threw her onto the bed and said, you're going to go to sleep. And she used her heels as hammers behind the door, like laying on the door with the heels going, bang, 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 let me out, let me out. And I pushed the door with her behind it and sort of squeezed it between the door and the wall and said, you're going to go to sleep. And like, if we were to go back, if somebody had seen it, I'm sure that they would have called one of the child protection services. And I do not say this in any way to excuse myself because it was appalling. It was disgraceful. It was completely and utterly shameful. And yet it happens in households around Australia on an everyday basis as usually toddlers, but sometimes teenagers and anyone in between have this power struggle, this conflict with usually their dad, sometimes their mom, but usually their dad. And dad just says, hey, I'm not going to take this. And that's what I did. I was basically saying to my three-year-old, you're not the boss of me. Which is exactly what they normally say to us, right?
Yeah.
But I remember at one point I was holding the door handle so she couldn't open the door. And I'm thinking, I swear, if she wakes up the baby, I'm just going to throttle her. And I'm holding the door as she's screaming, let me out. And I'm going, it's not my fault. Like she made me do this. If she would have just done as she was told. And yet anyone who's done any work in social services would know that that's exactly the line that men who hurt their wives, men who abuse their wives, it's a classic family violence lie, right? It's not my fault. She made me do it. But at the time in my head, it just seemed like it was the truth. I remember walking into the backyard when it all finished and a couple of different things happened as I there's no way that I was going to have a nap. She fell asleep on the carpet behind the door. I finally walked into the yard and two thoughts occurred to me. Number one, I remembered this quote that I heard when I was a kid. The only time that a father should ever lay his hands on his child is to bless them. And I thought, oh, wow. And that led to the second thought, Justin, you are a bad father. Like I really, and this wasn't a pity party. This was you actually suck. You have no idea what you're doing and you are hurting your children. You're hurting your family. This is a mess. So I'm kind of sitting there going, where do I go with this? What do I do? And across the back fence and down a few houses in a neighboring street, I heard the same. I heard my interaction with my daughter replayed between a dad and his toddler as he made a demand of the toddler and the toddler said no. And I heard the escalation. I heard the threats. I heard the smacking. I heard the baby screaming and it just sickened me in my stomach. I was like, wow, this is horrendous. So when Kylie came home, she was surprised to see me awake and I explained in detail. I didn't spare anything. I said, I've had a bad afternoon. Here's what I've done. Here's how it happened. And I didn't spare her any information. I just thought this is kind of like a moment of truth. This is, my wife needs to know what she's married. Mm-hmm. And I was expecting, because Kylie is so kind and so, she's just such an incredible person. And I was expecting that she'd kind of put her arms around me and say, it's all right, you've had a tough day and you were tired. And I was kind of hoping for a bit of sympathy. And what I got instead was a crestfallen look and then a moment of truth where she said to me, you are not the father I hoped you'd be. Mm. And hearing that, I was like, oh, wow. And then if I recall correctly, she said something like, now that I think about it, you're not quite the husband I hoped for either. And it was just like, what does this mean? What does this mean for us, for our family, for our relationship? What does it mean for me? What does it mean? Where do we go from here? And so we had a long conversation and I told her that I didn't want to be who I was. Over the next couple of months, we made the decision for me to leave the radio industry, go back to school, bearing in mind that I'd failed high school. Mm-hmm. So I had to do a year at TAFE and then I did 4 years of undergraduate psychology and ended up with a first class honours in psychological science, which was so funny, right? I'm at UQ, University of Queensland, one of the best psychology schools in the country. And I've gone from 10 years earlier, completely failing school, to now I've got a first class honours in psych science. But anyone who's ever done a psych degree would know that you don't learn a lot about parenting in an undergrad psych degree. Maybe 2 or 3 hours of parenting content across the entire 4 years. Yeah. So it's been 5 years of full-time study while we're paying off a mortgage. We've had our third and fourth children while I'm doing my undergrad. And I went and did a PhD. We moved to Wollongong. We relocated. I spent the next 3.5 years studying for a PhD, earned that, worked as a lecturer and as an academic, worked in the Illawarra Institute for Mental Health and the School of Psychology at University of Wollongong. And along the way, I learned all of these things that fundamentally changed our family, changed my relationship with my wife, and literally turned everything on its head. And realized as I was working academically that the stuff at uni that really turned me on, the stuff that I loved to do, was not sitting in front of a computer doing analysis of research data, but it was actually standing in front of groups and lecturing, teaching them all this awesome stuff that I'd learned over the previous 8.5, 9 years. Made the decision to start speaking and turn that into a full-time business. And so for the last decade and a half, I've traveled around Australia, I've written books, and essentially presented to people what they can do to be happier and how they can make their families happier. That's my full-time gig now. I've written 8 books. My 9th book comes out in a month or two, all about dads. Yeah. My most recent one only came out at the start of May, and that was called The Parenting Revolution. And I'm so stoked about this book. And we've got a TV show. It's on Channel 9 called Parental Guidance. People will probably be aware of it because season 2 is everywhere. So that's what I do now. I help people to make their families happier.
Yeah, that's incredible. And what I really appreciate about your story, Justin, is I think a lot of dads listening to this could relate to that moment where they went, actually, I'm not being the dad that I wanted to be, or I thought I could be, or that I'd hoped I'd be. And even for a lot of dads, there might be a bit of, oh, I'm just like my dad and I didn't want to be like that. And I didn't want to do those things. And just to see that transformation then to I'm being a crap dad to basically like Australia's most trusted dad, is an incredible transition. And I guess if it's okay, if we could we zoom back into that moment and what were some of those things that you started to change about the way that you parented and the way that you responded to your wife? Because I think, you know, a lot of the dads that are listening to this are new dads or even expecting dads. What are some of those easy sort of first wins that they can zoom into in terms of just their mindset or basic decisions and behaviors that they need to be or they can be implementing to make that switch from this isn't the dad I wanted to be?
So there are so many different ways we could go here. I'm not going to say any of these in any order. I'll just go with whatever sort of has popped into my head as you've asked the question.
Yeah, of course.
The first thing that I want to emphasize is that I really thought that the way I saw the world was the way it was.
Yeah.
And one of the most important and valuable lessons that I've learned, and bear in mind, Kylie and I have been married for 25 years now. So we're kind of, it's starting to get serious. We're starting to figure this out. And I think when I learned to begin to listen to my wife, that was a fundamental change because I really thought that I knew. I really thought that I can figure this out. Like I'm capable. And this is the thing, right? We go to work and we're good at what we do. We get paid, we solve problems, we fix things, and we kind of come home and think that relationships should just work at home the way everything else works at work. And it doesn't. It's such a different environment and the relationships are different. So that would be the first thing. The second thing that I would say is having the strength in the relationship, like that couple relationship. It's really, this is a provocative thing to say, and it's also a hard thing to say, but I really believe that the strength of the family is based on the strength of the couple relationship.
Yeah.
And there are many people who have created strong families in spite of relationships that aren't great, but often that requires a separation. Yeah. If the relationship is faulty, if the relationship is weak, if there's problems there, it's really hard to build a strong family on a weak foundation.
Yeah.
And learning how to both listen to and genuinely, absolutely, profoundly love your wife or your partner is just extraordinary. We create little rules like we never walk past each other without touching each other. A little stroke on the arm or a quick kiss or a hug or a squeeze of the backside, whatever. Like,
yeah.
There's something about the acknowledgement of one another, the willingness to listen, things like, whenever I ring Kylie, she answers the phone and she answers it with a level of enthusiasm. Like, this is the best thing that's happened to me today. My husband is ringing me like that. So when I ring her, even if I'm frustrated and she says, oh, I'm so glad you called me. Like, that's how she answers the phone. I'm so glad you called me. And I'll be like, oh, I can't be mad now, can I? Cause she's so glad. And I'll be like, oh, honey, I'm calling with a challenge and I've got to sort of shift the way I'm going to communicate with her because she's so glad that I called her because I matter that much to her. And we've kind of created these habits, these systems, these ways of acknowledging one another, which is so hard, especially in the early days when number one, you don't know how to do it. Number two, you're so exhausted because the kids are just so much, but little things like that. So that would be the first thing. The second central direction that I would go other than getting that adult to adult relationship strong is you can't parent, you can't think straight in a high emotion state. So we've got this website called happyfamilies.com.au. We've got a membership for parents. And one of our members, her name is Jess, she sent an email through. And I've got this saying that I say all the time, and that is that high emotions equals low intelligence. Mm-hmm. When you're emotionally up here, elevated, you just can't speak intelligently. You can't think clearly. Mm-hmm. And Jess didn't quite like that saying because she's sort of, for a range of reasons. She said, what about if you just said you can't think straight in a high emotion state? And I quite like that. So I've adopted it, Jess. When you go back to that moment, anybody who's rational would see that the child's getting worked up. The best thing for them is for a calm parent to help them to be nice and soothed and relaxed and maybe even to lay down on the bed with them and give them a great big hug and say, oh, you don't want to go to sleep at all. Let's just lay here and read a story. Because you can bet your bottom dollar that kid's going to be asleep in about 5 or 10 minutes. Does need a nap. And yet here I am going, I'm the dad and you will listen to me. And I'm getting caught up in this power trip rather than just going, tired child. What about if we just lay down and snuggle? I don't care if she sleeps in her cot or on the bed next to me. Who cares? As long as she's asleep. And so high emotions, low intelligence means if you find yourself in an interaction with a family member, child, partner, whatever, and things are starting to go sideways, just check your emotions. Because if they're escalating, I don't know if you've had this, Adam. Have you ever noticed that the angrier you are, the more right you are?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Yeah.
But then what happens is your emotions come back down and the anger dissipates. How right were you?
Not very.
Yeah, like I've said some of the most hideous things over the years. I've said really hurtful things to people because I've been really angry at them. And my perception, just the guy on the road that cut me off the other day, I described to him what he should do with the rest of his life. And And that seemed so appropriate at the moment. He could have killed me. But once I calmed down, I was like, I don't know if he even saw me.
Yeah.
And what was the point of me just blasting this guy? So high emotions, low intelligence, I guess, as parents, as dads, we've got to be able to keep our emotions stable and level. And sometimes we can be pretty volatile. I mean, we are taught as men that you get things done by making yourself as big and threatening and scary as you can.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a big power trip.
Yeah.
I reckon the second thing that I would say for any dad, and I mean, these are hard won lessons. They're not just built on research. They're built on experience raising six kids across the last 24 years. I wrote a book a couple of years ago about raising teenage girls. Obviously with six daughters of my own, I have a little bit of skin in the game, and I kept on describing how important it was that we are compassionate. And this is not a word that we usually ascribe to men.
Yeah.
Men aren't known for their compassion as a general rule. And yet when I think of the men that I feel that I can trust the most, there's this wonderful compassion that they have. And I looked up the etymology of the word, and I discovered that compassion has two Latin derivatives. The first part of the word com means together. With others, like we communicate, we're part of a company, we're part of a community, we engage in combat. COM is with others. Mm-hmm. The word passion, I always thought that I'm really passionate about surfing, or I'm passionate about, I don't know, business, or I'm passionate about Tony Robbins, let's walk across Hong Kong, passion. And when I looked it up, that's not what passion meant in the ancient Latin. What the word passion literally means is to suffer.
Mm-hmm.
So when we have compassion, we suffer together.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, research tells us that once males get to about the age of 12 or 13, they experience a significant decline in empathy. It's associated with the increase in testosterone that we have. Mm-hmm. There's a remarkable book that's been released recently by Carol Hooven called Testosterone. And even in that book, she describes how this decline in empathy coincides with this increase in testosterone as we enter puberty.
Wow.
And our testosterone stays really high. I mean, we have this massive boost through until we're about 40, basically from 13 through to 40. Our testosterone, you know what I'm trying to say? Testosterone is really high.
Yeah.
And then they slowly start to dissipate. But we're like 20 times higher, 30 times higher than women, right? And what we see during that period is empathy drops off a cliff. And it's not unless we really practice being empathic that we get it back. This is why so many men, honestly, are so willing to be violent, so willing to be bullheaded, so willing to get into a my chest's bigger than yours, let's see, you want to have a go, do you, kind of situations. When we step back and we have empathy, that helps us to be compassionate. And you can be as tough a man as you want out on the street, but when you're at home with your wife and your kids, they don't need a tough guy.
No.
They need compassion. And it took me such a long time to learn this, Adam, but what I've learned now is that when my children are struggling, when my children are having big emotions, when my children are exploding in frustration and anger, when they're exhausted, when they won't eat their dinner, they don't need me to blast them. They don't need me to turn into the tough guy.
Mm.
What they need is me to have compassion, which means they need me to suffer with them.
Mm.
And that's such a different thing. When I get down on the floor with a child who's struggling, I say, "You are having the hardest day. Do you need a hug?" It took me years to learn how to do that.
Yeah.
And to help my, and that kind of led to this thinking around what masculinity is. Because at the moment, masculinity is a kind of a controversial topic. The more I thought about masculinity, especially in relation to family life, the more convinced I am that if you're a real man, you help the people who are around you to feel safer and stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Real men help those around them feel safer and stronger. And when I go back to that afternoon, that Saturday afternoon with my baby girl, she did not feel safe and she definitely did not feel strong.
Mm.
And I was not being a real man. I was being an absolute jerk of the highest order. So this idea of compassion, I think, is profoundly important. And maybe the third thing, which took me a long time to learn as well, is just that our kids need to hear the three most important words that any parent can ever say to their child as often as possible, especially when things are tough. And of course, you know what those three most important words are, Adam. I mean, I probably don't need to ask you, but share them with me anyway.
I love you.
No, it's the three words that come next, no matter what. So when you've got a child who is losing it, it's great to say, hey, I love you. I love you. I love you. But what they really need is unconditional love, absolute unconditionality. And that's what they get from no matter what.
Yeah.
I had a teenage daughter recently who was not doing well at all. And she treated one of her sisters breathtakingly badly. And I had to intervene, and I asked her to just step out the front, just go out the front of the house and wait for me out there. And she said, I'm not going anywhere with you. And I said, that's okay. We don't even have to talk, but I just want you outside for a sec. We just got to create some space here. Mm-hmm. So she stepped outside. I made sure her sister was okay. She was. I stepped out and I said, we don't need to talk, but let's just walk to the front gate so that we can get a little bit of fresh air into our lungs and we can look up at the night sky and the stars. And I won't say anything to you, but let's just walk to the gate. And we walked to the gate and I knew it hadn't been enough calm down time. And I said, I promise I'm not going to talk, but we have not walked far enough. We're going to walk to the corner, which is a couple hundred meters. Yeah. And she said, I'm not going to the corner. I said, I promise we're not talking, but we do need to just walk to the corner. We need some space. So she reluctantly walked to the corner beside me. When we got to the corner, that had given me the space that I needed outside in the fresh air, away from all the chaos, to just think about what the parenting expert's supposed to do right now. And when we got to the corner, I looked at her and I said, I'm only going to say one thing to you, and we don't have to talk at all after that. And I put my arms on her shoulders and I said, you are having the hardest day. Tonight's been horrible. And you just hate everybody right now. And she kind of looked at me like she was not sure if she wanted to attack me or burst into tears. And I said to her, you just need to know that I love you no matter what. And then I just watched, you know, when somebody's about to cry and their whole face looks like it's about to melt off their skull. Like, I watched her whole face just turn into this great big droopy thing. And then the tears welled up in her eyes and she put her face into my shoulder and she just sobbed. Great big heaving sobs for 5 or 10 minutes as we stood on the street corner 200 meters down the road from our house, and I held her and she cried. And I just thought, oh man, what a difference. What a difference. Because the Justin Coulson 20 years ago, if that had been my teenage daughter then, there probably would have been holes in the walls. There would have been doors slammed. There would have been accusations. Maybe she would have run away. There would have been all this chaos and carnage. But instead, with that ability to regulate emotions, with some compassion, a willingness to suffer together, and the ability to say to a child, you matter unconditionally to me. I love you no matter what. Now I've got this teenager who's supposed to hate her dad, just saying, oh, and dad, I need you. Like, she's crying and sobbing. And once she'd cried for a bit, we talked about it as we walked back towards the house. And we talked about what we could do so that this never happens again.
Yeah.
And it still might, let's be honest, because we're all imperfect. And it was resolved within maybe 10 or 15 minutes. And she walked back into the house and everyone was breathing again. Everything was okay. So, I mean, they're just three ideas of hundreds that we could talk about.
Yeah. Yeah. Those three words, no matter what. I mean, even just hearing you talk about that interaction with your daughter, well, I just, you know, like, because I love you is easy. Or at least saying those three words is easy. Oh, that's a song lyric somewhere, I'm sure. Saying those three words is easy. But when you say no matter what, and you get into that unconditional sort of space where it is like, I will suffer with you because I love you no matter what, and I will empathize with you no matter what. And I think that is probably, as you say, like a very difficult thing for dads and for men, because it's everything about that masculinity, that image you were talking about, is about limits, isn't it? Like, well, I'll only say as much as I want to, and I'll, you know, or I'll only lift as much as I can get to, and then I've got to push that limit. So it's all about sort of blocking off. And what you're saying really is, well, actually, especially with our kids, we can't afford to do that, that they need to see these parts of ourselves that, that is unlimited. Yeah.
Adam, even as you said that, what do you reckon your child sees when you do let them see that part of yourself? Like, what are they seeing then versus What do they see when you've got this dad who's really constrained or this dad who's really angry? What are they seeing then? And what's that modeling for them? I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. I'd love to get your ideas on what that says to you.
Yeah, well, I think it's probably just that possibility that, hey, like I can feel things and I'm not going to explode, or I'm not going to be a bad person, or I'm not, you know, I can share thoughts and not be judged or criticized, that there's a safety within that. If my dad can do that, this, you know, and particularly for younger kids who see their dad's a superhero still, wow, if he can do that, like, what could that mean for me? Yeah.
Yeah. I really love that. I think it also sets I'm just thinking about what you were saying, and so I'm a dad of lots of daughters, obviously.
Mm.
My sense is that it gives them a sense of what they should be expecting in the boys or men that they spend time with. Like, it creates an expectation of, well, this is what a real man is.
Mm.
And if somebody is not man enough to show compassion, if they're not confident enough in their own masculinity to express themselves, then that's not the kind of man that I want to be around. I feel like there's something really there. And for fathers of boys, it teaches them, I think, profound safety, how to express yourself in a way that doesn't make the people around you terrified of you, which is, like I said, 20 years ago, I had no idea what that was.
Yeah. And I think too, even, you know, for those, there was that generation of dads where there was that aggression, but then there was also that absence. And I think it shows a presence that maybe as dads ourselves, we didn't see growing up from our fathers. And I think then it's part of that generational shift and part of that culture shift when we talk about fathering.
Yeah, I remember, I don't know, I have no idea who said this, and I've probably changed what they said anyway, but there was this idea that when we were growing up, the phrase used to often be, you just wait until your dad gets home. And I'm going to tell him when. And the idea there is that we're supposed to be terrified of our dads. Whereas for me, when my wife says to the kids, you just wait until dad gets home, I'm hoping that they're going to say, oh, I can't wait, because I know that he's going to understand. I know that I'll be safe when he gets home. I know that I'm going to get the cuddle that I need. I'm going to get the unconditionality that's so important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's beautiful. I wonder if we could sort of switch tact, and your website and your podcast are called Happy Families. And we've talked there about that partnership and that loving, trusting relationship in the couple. And I think that even plays in, you know, with step parents, or even in the case of separation, divorce, where there's still that respect in that relationship that becomes the foundation of the family, as you say. You talked about empathy, compassion, those three words, no matter what. With those things, what else would you say a happy family looks like, feels like, sounds like? What are some of the things that our dads who are listening can sort of go, okay, well, those are some things I can aim towards in how our family is as a unit.
Okay, so there's in my book, 21 Days to a Happier Family, I basically talk about how families that do the best do three things really well together. They love, they have limits, and they have laughter.
Mm.
Like as parents, sometimes we forget how to have fun.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not good for our family. The ability to laugh, to enjoy one another's company, to find delight in one another, to play games, to wrestle, to roughhouse, to kick a ball, throw a ball, go for a bike ride, have adventures. I can't believe how many families don't camp. I've got to say, I hate camping. I hate camping, but I love camping.
Yeah.
It's a pain. It's hard work. It requires more effort sometimes to just get everything out of the garage, stick it in the car, get to the campsite and set it all up. Then it's so much pain, but the kids love it. And once you're there, there's something like nature is fuel for the soul. Finding ways to have fun. I remember I was in a seminar one night, and we were talking about the idea of creating family traditions. And in our family, for many, many years, we don't do it very well anymore, but for many years, we did this thing called Super Saturday. Every Saturday, the kids growing up and having jobs kind of ruined this a bit for us, but Super Saturday was low cost or no cost activities for 2 hours on a Saturday. Saturday sport will ruin it as well. But
yeah,
we go for bushwalks. At the time, we were living in the Illawarra, so we would go to some of the beautiful, beautiful scenic places in the Royal National Park, or we'd go up to the Southern Islands and visit the waterfalls, or we just find, I remember one time we climbed up Sublime Point. There's this sign at the bottom of the walking track that says, no children allowed, a dangerous path. And the kids are like, oh, we can't do it. And I'm like, don't worry about the sign, kids. Let's just do this. Yeah. Whoa, really? They thought it was amazing. And I probably shouldn't admit that publicly. And it was pouring with rain and there were leeches. And when we got to the top so we could see the incredible lookout, we could only see 10 meters. I mean, it was just, it was a disaster. And the kids were crying because of the leeches and the wet weather and the fact that it was a disaster. When we got back to the car, they were like, that was the best day ever. Yeah. And just having fun. There was this guy, a Polynesian guy in the audience. I think he was like a Samoan guy. And he said, oh, we can't do Super Saturday because I work. But in our family, we've got this thing called Chip Tuesday. And I said, what's Chop Tuesday? And he said, well, every Tuesday night we get a loaf of bread and some tomato sauce. We go down to the fish and chip shop, buy some fish and chips, sit in the park on the water, and we eat fish and chips. It's our thing. And then we ride scooters or skateboards or push the kids on the swings, and that's Chip Tuesday.
Yeah.
Like, we don't have to, we don't, if you want to have a happy family, it actually requires work. It requires effort. It requires intention. It requires planning. You will not have a happy family if every weekend you sit around watching YouTube videos or Netflix. It's just not going to happen. It demands something of us. But parenting is kind of like investing financially, right? So not that I'm good at investing and not that I'm a financial guy, so I could get this a little bit wrong. But my understanding of superannuation, for example, is you put money in a little bit, bit by bit, drip, 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 drip it in. And over a long period of time, it eventually matures and you end up with a really nice reward at the end of 20 or 30 years. Mm-hmm. Parenting's the same. Mm-hmm. Drip, 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 drip it in through the ups and the downs, through the highs and the lows. And in 18 years' time, that child matures and then you get the benefit of having raised an adult. Yeah. But it requires consistent investment. If you only put superannuation in every 3 or 4 or 5 years, and you only put a small amount in here and then a big bit there, and you're going to get a lousy result. It's about the consistent, continued investment during the highs and the lows of the economic cycles.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And that is speaking right to me right now, because my wife and I are having, like, we're wanting to utilize our weekends better. We're both working through the week. I catch myself. She'll say, okay, we need to talk about what we're going to do on the weekend. And I'm just like, oh, we have to plan. Can we just, but you're right. Like, the spontaneity comes from the planning. And you can't just, can't just rely on, oh, well, we'll just make it up as we go. Like, unless you have that plan, you're right. You're not going to get off the couch. You're not going to get off the device. And, you know, like, we've got a little 17-month-old, so he's not going to push us out the door. So you're right. That planning is so key in terms of creating those opportunities for spontaneity and fun and laughter. Like, they don't just happen.
There's a critical statement that you just made, and it deserves underlining and sort of a red pen around it. The spontaneity comes from the planning. I can't remember exactly how I said it, but when I used to be a radio announcer, I used to write out pretty much everything I was going to say because it gave me the freedom to then ad lib, knowing that if I got a little bit lost, I could come back to the plan and I could finish my talk break the right way. But if I just open up the mic with no plan and just thought, oh, I'm going to be spontaneous, it never sounded as good as if it was planned.
Yeah.
It was just always so much easier to execute a well-planned talk break. Yeah. And it's exactly the same when it comes to a well-planned weekend. You plan it, and then when you're at the beach or when you're doing the hike or when you're watching the game or whatever you're doing, that's when you're like, hey, while we're here, let's do that spontaneous thing. Yeah. But it's the plan that creates the opportunity. You've got to have the plan. And I know a lot of people like you. You've got two people working. You've got high mortgage stress and everything costs an absolute fortune right now. And you're kind of thinking, oh, I just don't know. But there's, like I said, low cost or no cost. And it's only a couple of hours. I know you've got to do the laundry. I know you've got to do the vacuuming. I know the shopping's got to be done, but it's only a couple of hours. And you can do it. Especially, I mean, you've got a 17-month-old, so you can do it at 7 a.m., right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There are things that you can do if you're willing to be be flexible and play around with it. Just play around with it and make it happen. In my family growing up, we had a consistent, I can't remember what night it was. I think it was Monday night. Every Monday night, there were no activities. It was just family night. And mum and dad were there and we read stories, we played games, we made treats in the oven or on the stove or whatever. Like we just had fun. And that was the thing that we did to make sure that we got high quality family time at least once a week, not including the weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing I'm learning with that too is like that, even when they are little and they can't push you out the door, it's even more important because you don't know, you know, if their sleep schedule is going to go out of whack, if they're going to, you know, catch something from daycare. That planning is so key. Oh man, we caught so much from daycare this month. It's crazy. And I think too, you know, you talked about those three things that make a happy family: love, limits, laughter. I think planning is part of all of that. Like you've got to plan, you know, sit down. I know my wife and I, we sit down, we talk about, okay, like what do we want our boy hearing in terms of, you know, like we don't just want to say, oh, good boy. Like how do we express love and affirmation and the same with the limits? Like how do we implement limits? Like screen time is just such an easy one for us at the moment of, oh, you know, just chuck them in front of the iPad and then we can clean up the kitchen. But it's like, no, actually, like how are we going to implement stuff before we get to that situation so that we can actually do something that's values-based instead of just reactionary?
Yeah, the intention is so, so valuable. I love hearing what you're describing there. Wish more parents were willing to have those conversations.
Yeah. I'm wondering with that word limits, like, and I've heard some of your stuff around discipline and how do we implement some disciplinary stuff. What would you say to our dads? Because I think for a lot of dads, the model has been either the angry dad who imposes his will, or the absent dad who just, you know, sort of stands back. How can we find the balance between the two in modeling as fathers, as men, how we can implement limits within a family context?
Yeah, and you also get the Disneyland dad who just do whatever they want. I'm just going to pick up my brand new book.
Yeah, please.
So this one's just come out. It's called The Parenting Revolution.
Yeah.
And it's very much about answering that question. So if I was to pull it back, the word discipline is often confused, especially today. If you look up the word discipline in the dictionary today, the first word in the dictionary to describe discipline is punishment.
Yeah.
But if we go back to Merriam-Webster's 1820 dictionary and anything prior to that, the word discipline actually used to have quite a different connotation, different meaning entirely. So let's talk about punishment first, because that's what we describe discipline as today, is punishment.
Yeah, yeah.
If you look up punishment in the dictionary, there's a couple of definitions that stand out. The first one is to exact retribution. Mm. So when I'm looking at my three-year-old and she won't go to sleep, if I think that she needs discipline, that is, if I think she needs punishment, what I'm really saying is I need to exact retribution on my three-year-old for not sleeping.
Yeah.
And the other definition is to inflict loss or pain. Mm. To inflict loss or pain. That's the other word for the other definition for punishment. And I don't know about you, Adam, but I just feel so uncomfortable with those definitions. And if we see discipline and punishment as interchangeable words, therefore we're basically saying my job as a parent is to inflict loss or pain and to exact retribution on my children when they don't do what I did. The idea being that if we do that, that they're going to learn their lesson.
If I can jump in, it sounds like the lowest form of compassion. Like, well, I'm going to suffer, so you suffer.
Oh, it's an absolute of compassion. Yeah, it's almost
the opposite. Together. Yeah.
There is no suffering. I guess I'm suffering because you're an ignorant three-year-old. Now I'm going to make you suffer for making me suffer. But it's this retributional approach.
And
when I wrote The Parenting Revolution, I leaned really heavily on this psychological theory that's called self-determination theory. Mm. What it argues is that we have three basic psychological needs. And when we are in an environment that supports those needs, we thrive, we flourish, we get the best possible outcomes. So the first of those basic psychological needs is what psychologists call relatedness, a sense of connection, a sense of belonging. If you're in a punishing relationship, you can probably imagine what that does to your sense of relatedness. It frustrates that psychological need quite profoundly.
Yeah.
The second basic psychological need is what psychologists describe as competence. or a feeling that I'm mastering my environment, a feeling of capability and capacity. What I think is really interesting there is when we rely on typical punishment strategies, we're crushing competence under our heel. We're basically saying, you screwed it up, you can't do it, you're no good, and this is the price you're going to pay. We're actually highlighting, we're putting up in neon lights our children's incompetence. And of course, we're destroying the relationship as well. The relationship ruptures. So that's two out of two that punishment destroys when it comes to fundamental, basic, core psychological needs. The third one is autonomy. Autonomy meaning a sense of volition and choice. Now, I know some people are going, yeah, but you don't give autonomy to a three-year-old. Well, actually, you do. Not that you let three-year-olds rule the house, although some parents probably do, but they've got to have a sense of volition and choice in their lives. And again, punishment just crushes, destroys all three of those basic psychological needs. Now, if we were to spin it around and talk about discipline, the old-fashioned definition for discipline prior to 1820 was teaching, guiding, instructing. So punishment, in a word, is hurting. Discipline, in a word, is helping. So when somebody says, well, you really need to discipline that child, I say, yes. Yes, you really do need to help that child to learn. You need to teach, guide, and instruct that child. And we take a fundamentally different approach when we teach, guide, and instruct to when we punish, hurt, whatever. I'm going to get you to do something just for fun. You've got a piece of paper in front of you. I've been watching you draw some notes. So I do this in so many of my parenting workshops. I've done this with tens of thousands of parents. I just want you to draw a picture of a house for me, okay? And for anyone who's listening, just imagine that you're drawing a picture of a house. My guess, in fact, I'm watching you draw it now. You've just finished it. Can you hold it up to our Zoom screen? And I'm going to describe it to everyone who's listening. So you've essentially drawn a box with a triangle on top.
Yep.
Okay. And 99.9% of the tens of thousands of parents who have done that activity with me over the years have drawn exactly that. In fact, yours was a little bit nicer than the average one. You've got some artistic ability there. But it was still fundamentally, it's a box with a triangle on top. Now, some people go a little bit further. They put a little rectangular chimney there and they put a couple of square windows in or a door with a little pathway, but it's always the same thing. So I want to ask you the same question that I ask my workshop participants. Why are you still drawing the same house that you drew when you were six?
I think to use those words, I think it's the competence. I don't think I have the confidence to draw something else.
Okay, so competence and capability. Why else though? There has to be some other reasons that you drew that house other than just a skill or a lack thereof.
Probably because that's just what was shown. You know, draw a house, here's what you're going to draw. So, yeah, that the autonomy,
Okay. And if we had time to really flesh this out and we had a bigger audience, people would say things like, because it's quick, because it's easy, because you didn't give me any more time. Not that I gave you a time limit, but these are the kinds of things that people will say. Yeah. So here's my next question. How does the standard Aussie parent discipline their kids? And I use the word discipline in the loosest possible terms here. Yeah. And if you're struggling to answer that question, just think about what your sister-in-law or your neighbor does, right? What's the standard Aussie parenting practice when it comes to discipline? Hit me with I don't know, the three or four that spring to mind first.
Oh, look, the first thing that comes to mind is just sort of the yelling, like imposing. These are the boundaries sort of thing. As horrible as it is to admit, I think there's probably a fair level of like physical nature to it as well, in terms of, you know, sort of forcing a child to do what you want them to do, and just rules, loads and loads of rules. And if you don't follow my rules,
Yep, cool. So what I've written down is yelling, smacking, and just having lots of rules. Unfortunately, around about 70% of Australian parents still say that they hit their kids. 63 nations around the world have outlawed it. But in Australia, we hang on to our right to hit our kids. And I just want to, there's a lot of dads who are going to be listening to this who are going to be like, yeah, well, you should be able to whack your kids now and then. Like, I mean, 70% of Australian parents say that they do. I want to put this into perspective for a moment. So your child is 17 months old right now, Adam. Let's imagine that that this kiddo has grown up to the age of two. At the age of two, children are usually half of what their adult height will be. Give or take, something around there. So, and what do you weigh?
About 85.
Okay. And what's your child weigh?
Probably about 12 at the moment.
Okay. All right. So I'm not really great at maths, but 12's into 85. Let's say that's somewhere around about, I've got to do some maths here. 12, 24, 36, 48, 60, 72, 84. So that's 7.
Yeah.
All right. So just pause for a moment and imagine that you've done something stupid at work and your boss weighs 7 times your weight. So you're in the 80s, 7 times 8. If I've done my maths correctly, I think that's 560.
60, yeah.
So you've got a 560 kilo boss who's also twice your height. So they're standing somewhere around, 2.5, 3 meters tall. Yeah. Let's say 3 meters. Oh, no, 3.5 meters tall. They're 3.5 meters tall. You've got this giant of a boss, 3.5 meters tall and 560 kilos, that leans over the top of you and points their finger at you and says, "What were you thinking?" Because, of course, they're going to say it in some random voice like that.
Yeah,
and
they're
"What were you thinking?" And you're like, your brain shuts down. Remember, high emotions, intelligence, your brain shuts down. And then you do or say something silly. And then they say, "I'm just going to give you a tap on the bum so that you can learn your lesson." Can you imagine getting a tap on the bum from somebody who's 560 kilos and 3.5 meters tall? Like,
no way.
Terrifying.
It'd be like getting dunked on by Shaquille O'Neal.
Yeah. I think it'd be scarier. Like, it would be terrifying. And every single day I meet parents who say, "It's just a tap." And I'm like, let's put this in perspective.
Yeah.
When you're just tapping a toddler, and then some parents will say, "Oh yeah, but you can't reason with a toddler." And I'll say, "But you can't reason with an 80-year-old dementia patient either. No. So should we start hitting them?"
Yeah.
Crazy. Like, we've got to come up with something else. Now, let's go back to the house for a second. You drew the house because it was what you've been shown, and that's your current skill level, and it was quick and easy, and it just got the job done.
Yeah.
And I think that we use the discipline strategies we do for the same reason we draw the houses we do.
Yeah, yeah.
So fundamentally, and I'm not trying to turn this conversation into a plug for my book.
But
that's not the intention. But when I wrote The Parenting Revolution, it was basically saying we don't need to get our kids in trouble.
No.
What we need to do is create an environment where their basic psychological needs can be met, where they feel close and safe, where they have us helping them to develop competence. Like, if your child is hitting their sibling, or if your child is saying no and they won't go to sleep, or what, it's just they haven't figured out how to regulate their emotions yet. They haven't. And our job is to help them to become competent.
Yeah.
And then we give them choices so they can figure out how to do it better next time. And there's a bit of a process around that. But essentially what we're really trying to do is say, you had a hard time. I call it the 3 E's of effective discipline. We explore what's going on for them. We explain what we expect, because you've got to have limits. And then we empower them in a collaborative way to come up with a solution so that we can get this right next time.
And I like what you say about next time as well. Like, it's not just you have to get it right the first time or else. Like, if we did that with everything with our kids, they would walk, eat, talk, anything. So,
what about your wife? If she did that with you, how would that relationship be looking? Like, she would have walked out, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You've made the same mistake more than once, Adam. I'm guessing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's an important one as well. Like, when we assess things as adults, it's almost like that perfectionism or that high achievement of like, you've got to get this right. And, you know, here's this little human that's been around, not even, in my case, not even 2 years. And it's like, well, why can't you run yet? without the little duck waddle, why can't you kick a ball or catch a ball or hello? Yeah. So I think that next time is such a key there for particularly for our dads listening to this. Like, how do you just take that step back, get that perspective, as you say, Justin? And I like that explore as well, like coming at it with a curiosity of, well, what could be going on?
If we were to go all the way back to that story I told about my teenage daughter being upset, I did a condensed version of that with her on that corner. Rather than really exploring in the moment, because she was pretty emotional, I just said, "I can see you're having an awful night. You've had a really tough day and you're feeling awful." And what I'm really doing there is I'm exploring. I'm showing some compassion. I'm showing some empathy, and I'm exploring how she must be feeling.
Yeah.
Didn't ask her to feed that back to me because I knew that wasn't the time, but just giving the kids that language, letting them know that their emotions are a normal part of the human experience and that they're not going to be, they're not going to be punished for having those emotions. Ironically, paradoxically, the acceptance of the emotions in the appropriate environment with appropriate limits, the acceptance of the emotion helps the child to manage the emotion more effectively, get over the emotion faster, and then get on with life. It's kind of like, I mean, let's just say you and I are in a couple relationship. Adam, I'm your wife, and I'm having a really, really horrible time. And you say what so many men say to their wives. You say, oh, for goodness sakes, I don't know why you're making such a big deal about this.
Yeah.
Why don't it just calm down? It's not that big a deal. Has your wife ever looked at you when you said that to her and said, good point, I am overdoing it. Thanks for the reminder. I appreciate how rational you are, Adam.
Never happened. Pigs flying right now.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. Whereas, and because what you're doing there is you're disapproving of the emotion, you're dismissing the emotion, and it reinforces the emotion she's feeling. It amplifies and magnifies the emotion. Whereas if you came home and you said to me, honey, it looks like you've just had a really tough day. Do you want a hug? Do you want to talk about it? Do you want some space? What do you need from me? Like, I'm going to guess. What would your wife's response be to that?
She would be very, very happy that I've responded. That would be a happier family.
Yeah. And yet we feel like we've got to logic the emotion out of people or punish the emotion out of people. And it makes such a difference when we just say, wow, this has been a really, really hard thing for you.
Yeah.
And then you give them their autonomy. Do you want some space right now? Or do you want a hug? Do you want to talk about it? Or do you just need some space? And all of a sudden, what you've done is you meet those three basic psychological needs, because you're saying the relationship matters. Yeah. I'm connecting with you. I also believe that you're capable of figuring out where to go and what to do here. And I'm going to give you the autonomy to do it. And let you choose. Do you want me in your space? Do you want some space? At the start of the conversation, when you asked me initially how to have a happy family, and I said the couple relationship's super important. Took me too many years to learn this, but that one line, maybe one of the most valuable things that I learned as a husband is to say to my wife, do you want some space, or do you want me to hang around and be close to you? What do you need? Yeah. Just giving my wife the autonomy and recognizing that she's got the capability. Like, she's a fully functional human being. She's capable of figuring this stuff out. Oh my goodness. It changed our relationship at every level, because she saw the respect that I had for her and the willingness that I had to let her figure things out. And more often than not, she said, yeah, I want you near me. I need a hug. I'm having a horrible day, because she felt safe enough to invite me close. Same with the kids.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Justin, this has just been incredible. I'm worried that if I ask you any more questions, no one will have to buy any of your books, because you just laid it all out for us. I'm so appreciative for your time and for your insight. For our dads that do want to buy your books and read more or follow you, where can they find your books and other resources that you create?
So my membership is at happyfamilies.com.au, and that's what I recommend people get onto. The sooner you start this, the sooner you can make the changes that are going to be of most benefit to your family. So happyfamilies.com.au, just click on the membership thing. It's like $18 a month, or if you sign up for a year, we give you 2 months free.
Yeah,
so it's $180 for a month. It's cheaper than Netflix, and it's going to make a bigger difference to how happy your family is. So, like, that's the number one thing that I would recommend people check out. Beyond that, though, all my books are available wherever you get books. Just look up my name and go to, I don't know, Booktopia or Amazon or Dimmicks or whatever. Of course, my podcast, Happy Families, the Happy Families podcast. My wife and I drop 15-minute conversations each day about what it takes to raise a happy family.
Yeah, awesome. And of course, season 2 of the TV show coming out on 9.
Yeah, right? Parental Guidance. Yeah. The date is to be disclosed very, very soon. So here it comes. And it's going to be so good. Such a great show.
Yeah, can't wait. Awesome. Dr. Justin Coulson, thank you so much for your time.
It's been so much fun, Adam. Thanks.
Thanks.
Awesome. And we also want to thank our listener for tuning in today. If you haven't already, go check out our website at www.dadsgroup.org. In this space, we've got some awesome resources for support for families, new and expecting families, There's a lot of mental health support there by some amazing organizations. On this website as well, you can also support Dad's Group through purchasing our merchandise, or a solid donation would be amazing and help us impact the lives and of new and expecting families all around Australia. But thank you guys so much for tuning in, and we'll catch you next week. Cheers, guys.